Hi, Clutter Fairy fans. This is the Clutter Fairy Weekly for October 5th, 2021. I'm your co-host, Ed Gumnick, and I'm speaking with Gail Goddard, certified professional organizer and owner of The Clutter Fairy in Houston, Texas.
Hi, everybody. The Clutter Fairy Weekly is a webcast and podcast where we dig deep into the clutter that stands between people and the lives they want to be living. We aim to make sense of where so much stuff comes from in the first place, and we offer strategies to slow down the accumulation, reduce the collection, and comfortably manage the stuff we choose to keep. We rely heavily on the questions and topic suggestions we get from you, our viewers and listeners.
If you're joining us in the Zoom meeting for the first time, you can share your comments and questions via the chat, and I'll try to make sure Gail gets to them before we move on to another topic. You can also use the raise hand feature if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question yourself via audio or video. We are also streaming the webcast live on Facebook, so you can share your questions and suggestions there. And I'll relay them to Gail. And during the live webcast every week, you can talk to us by phone by calling 669-900-6833. Use meeting ID 993-419-863 and password clutter to join the meeting. We're going to start this week, as we usually do, by talking about last week's tittle, which was called The Great Outdoors. The assignment was to evaluate an outdoor space, a garage, patio, balcony, deck, or even just a windowsill. That's a sort of quasi-outdoor space, to make sure that it's serving your life the way you want it to. Let's hear from our participants in Zoom and Facebook who cleared, worked on, or at least thought about an outside space this week. Please let us know in the comments. Tennessee Nana on YouTube reports, last spring I bought a shelving unit for my garage, which works wonderfully. While assembling it and then filling it, I decided to make April 1st and also October 1st my official garage cleaning out days. That way I do it every 6 months, so it's not such a huge job with years of accumulation.
That is such a great idea. I love it that you sort of tied it to the changing of the seasons, when it's likely to be tolerable to be in their garage in the spring and in the fall. It's going to be more reasonable to be out there. And also the idea that you're recognizing that going into it twice a year helps you stay on top of it and means that you don't have to do the whole garage all at once if you don't want to. If you know you're going to come back and do some more later, then you can concentrate on an area, and 6 months later you come concentrate on another area, and eventually it'll be a much smaller and smaller job every 6 months when you go in there. What a great idea for spanning out the work and tying it to when there's likely going to be sort of a junk. You can get it tied to when a junk haul, if it's going to happen, and you can make that garage livable and manageable. Great idea. Good job.
Connie says, set up space in spare / storage / dorm. Well, she wrote doom room. I don't know if that, she means dorm room, or there may be more to that story for right. Plants that need to go indoors in winter. Diane said, I was in the outside space in the mountains last week. Jealous.
Oh, that's lovely. How wonderful.
Joyce says, I cleared the shelf at my entranceway by my front door. No outdoor storage allowed.
Good. And so it's by your entranceway.
Deborah moved some herbs from the courtyard up to her flat for the winter.
Y'all are doing it. That's awesome. And that's I think that plant shift from it can be outside to it has to be inside. That's sort of a major project that you have to plan and manage. And hopefully none of the pots are too big to carry when you go along to try to do the work.
Lee said, I cleared debris from the patio and falling apart shed.
There you go. That's a good one.
And Naomi reports that this evening is the time to bring in the outdoor plants. It's going down to freezing tonight in Edmonton. Ooh,
okay. It's time. Oh. Awesome.
Connie says it is doom room. She wrote that on purpose. It's her daughter's former bedroom that is now the biggest storage closet we ever had.
That's one way to make sure she can't move back in,
right?
To make her room into a storage unit. Not the first parent that I've heard that did that.
My parents solved that problem by giving my room away to one of my sisters.
Oh, there you go. And can't move back in with her, right? That's hilarious. The gym room.
Matrey, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, so I apologize, said, I got rid of cleaning supplies and took them to the garage away from my toddler's reach. Garage is clear and I have some peace of mind.
There you go. Yeah, you definitely don't want the toddler being able to get into the chemical. So good job relocating so that it's safer for them. That's excellent. Y'all are doing great.
And Anita says, I realize that I have two storage areas for garden tools and two complete sets of rakes, shovels, etc. I'm going to move one small shed so it is equidistant from both gardening areas and donate the excess tools to the Nature Center garden where I volunteer.
Oh, that's a great idea. What a great adaptation. And as long as you're out there doing gardening anyway, if you can walk between the two of them from the shed and it's not too much of a burden, then everything's available for whichever place you're going to go. That's awesome. I like that.
And Rowan, our resident angel of organizing, said, my friend and I continue to deal with her garage. We will move on to the shed and storage unit this week.
Yay. Good job. And it's a great time of year to do it. So, and I'm sure that your friend appreciates the support and extra help while doing it. Now you see what it's like to be working with somebody so that it's a team effort instead of a solo one. And I'm sure it makes it much easier for her that you're there being friendly and helpful and helping her do it. So yay, spreading organizing around the world. She told me that she sent me a text and said that she's gotten everything organized in her own house. And so she's sort of resorted to standing on the street and, you know, whistling at passersby, hey, do you need some organizing help? So now she's helping her friend, and that's awesome. She's getting her organizing fix, and she's spreading organizing help in the universe. So this is awesome.
Excellent.
Right.
Okay, we should move on to our main topic. A lot of conflicting factors compete in our heads as we weigh whether to keep or let go of stuff. Thoughts and feelings about price, value, beauty, and sentiment struggle against harsh realities of space limitations, dust, time, mobility, and so on. Today, we want to examine factors that contribute to the complexity of our keep toss decisions and offer strategies for making choices that work for your life.
We want to start by talking for a moment about mental models. What are they and how do they work? So mental models are representations that our brains use to try to explain how things work in the real world, the relationship between various parts of reality, and our perceptions of our own actions and their consequences. You might think of mental models as small sketches or diagrams or cartoon versions of the big world. Think about a Hot Wheels car. It's a tiny, simplified model of a real car, but it conveys the essential ideas of what a car is, what it looks like and how it moves at a level that a child can understand. Mental models can take the form of fables, stories, aphorisms, rules, metaphors, similes. For example, Aesop's fable about the ant and the grasshopper is a mental model for the real world idea that there's a time for work and a time for play. The ant being about working, right? Since we can't carry the whole world around in our brains, we collect sets of mental models that we then use to shape our behavior and to approach solving problems and doing tasks. Mental models are a way that we simplify the complex world into understandable and organizable chunks. They help us explain to ourselves and to others how the world works, and they can help us make decisions. The simplicity of our mental models makes them useful, but imperfect tools. Without them, we would have to fall back on living our lives using nothing but habit or instinct. But we tend to rely on a small, familiar set of models instead of looking for new ones or examining whether the tools we've been using are really the best ones for the job. I'm sure you've heard the saying that if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem starts to look like a nail. That saying is itself a mental model for the idea that we're better off if our toolbox contains several tools suited to different jobs. So let's look at some commonly held mental models and how they affect the process of organizing your stuff and your space. We'll start by trying to understand a few mental models that may contribute to our accumulation of stuff. Let's see if these sound familiar. So one of them is about social proof. This is the tendency to look for safety in numbers by following the behavior of other people, especially in times of uncertainty. We've talked about this a while back when we examined the notion that every home has a formal dining room. So that's sort of a social concept that everybody got used to having a dining room. We all needed a formal dining room. And so every household had one and went along with setting up a formal dining room, even if they didn't use it as a formal dining room. Another mental model around the accumulation of stuff is about scarcity. We tend to place a higher value on things that are scarce and a lower value on things that are abundant. And marketers create the illusion of scarcity by putting expiration dates on sales. Oh, the sale is only until the end of the week. By only placing a few items on a store shelf at a time, or by making online items with tags like, there's only one seat left at this price, so you better buy it, is the implication. Another mental model that might help you accumulate stuff is the idea that it's irreplaceable. Connected to the notion of scarcity is the idea that there are things that we hold on to because it would be difficult or even impossible to replace them. This idea is often what compels us to keep family heirlooms, photographs of ancestors we don't know, yearbooks, and other mementos. Sometimes we rely on mental models that tend to make us hold on to things after we stop needing, wanting, or appreciate them. So one of those mental models is the sunk cost idea. We've talked about the sunk cost fallacy before, which is the tendency to value things in terms of the money that we spent to obtain them. But what we paid for something shouldn't be a factor in our decision whether to keep it. That decision should be based on whether the value of keeping the thing is greater than the value of letting it go. And that brings us to recovering the cost. Related to the sunk cost fallacy is the notion that everything that we paid money for retains some of that monetary value. And that if we're willing to do the work to find a buyer, we can recover a portion of what we paid. So that is a mental model that we work from a lot. And that might be true. If you have a lot of time and energy, it's not already committed to the process of living your life. But if time and energy are scarce, you have to weigh the money that you might recover against all your other priorities. Another mental model that helps us accumulate stuff is sort of a status quo bias, the tendency to find comfort and safety in the place where we find ourselves right now, even when it's less than ideal. It's very natural and human to default to the position that change is bad, but we can't grow without changing. Obviously, we can't move toward a better life if we're acting from the assumption that the way things are right now is as good as they're going to get. Another mental model that helps us keep things is the idea of confusing our stuff with ourselves. So sometimes we use the stuff that decorates or accessorizes our lives to shore up shaky self-esteem. This is another way of thinking that's hugely influenced by marketing and advertising. People with stuff to sell work really hard to convince us that the product they're selling will make us more beautiful or more elegant or more popular or more hip or more cool. Cool is a good one. And that it'll make our lives more fun and interesting. That mental model drives you to accumulate stuff that you most likely don't actually need. All they've done is convince you that you need it in according to their definition of what your life should be like. And so we end up acquiring things that only someone else thinks that we need, that we don't actually need. So those are a rundown of models that might be currently in use in your life and that are helping you accumulate things. But here's some good news. You're not stuck with those mental models. You're allowed to reject ones that are keeping you stuck, and you're allowed to adopt new ones to help shift your thinking about your life and your things. part of what we'd always try to do with this group and this webcast is to encourage people who struggle with clutter to adopt new models, to think about new metaphors, to tell new stories, and to think about renewed versions of ourselves. We've also talked on several occasions about creating algorithms to add objectivity and remove some of the emotional weight from keep toss decisions. Algorithms are mental models of our own design. For example, if you decide that you have as many pairs of shoes as you can fit in your house, then your shoe management algorithm might be, every time I buy a new pair of shoes, I have to donate or discard one pair. That's a bare bones example, but there's an underlying mental model that it requires you to accept and acknowledge, which is that your space is a finite resource. So let's talk about some mental models that might help us make clear decisions about what we want to keep and what we're ready to let go of. In terms of balance, we can think of life in terms of balance. So we start with the mental model of our homes as a kind of delicate balancing act. In the ideal, we want to have enough stuff to carry out all the functions of our lives, but not so much stuff that the volume becomes an obstacle to our movement or our safety or our ability to find what we need at any particular moment. If you're here listening to us, though, you probably find yourself with that act somewhat out of balance, that your space versus use versus quality of life is a little out of balance. Another metaphor we might consider is a balanced scale. So the old type of scale where you loaded weights on one side and things to be weighed on the other, our challenge is to reduce the load on the stuff we keep side of the scale until it reaches balance with the stuff that we really use and need. This is a good one that Ed thought of, which is second order thinking. So if you think about first order thinking, it's what we are doing when we consider the immediate results of our actions. Our first order thinking is, here's an example. If I get rid of this book that I've had for 10 years, but I have never read, then I won't be able to read it in the future. Second order thinking is thinking farther ahead and more broadly. If I donate this book to the library, they'll sell it to raise money, and someone who's ready to read it right now will get their hands on it. Now you're thinking of terms in terms of how it affects more than just you. So the first order thinking is, what is the immediate result to you of your response of what you do about it? The second order thinking is, how will that affect in a broader environment, more people just beside you? You can aim to trade up these models as well, replacing an old model for a new model. One that immediately comes to mind to me is about keepsakes. So if your current mental model says, for instance, I keep everything related to family memories of any generation or all things related to my children. If that's your default model filter for your objects in the house, your keepsakes, then upgrading that model might sound like this. I save a representative sample of things that remind me of happy family times. So this is an upgrade because I've changed it to be a sampling instead of all things, and because I've specified happy memories instead of any memories or specifically excluding unhappy ones. Think about my client who can't let go of all the things that remind her of her ex-husband and his cheating and his negative dealings with her about splitting up their money. I think she'd be a happier person if she could let go of some of those reminders. In my mind, why live with things that make you feel terrible? The divorce is a decade old and it's not changing. So those reminders feel like salt in a wound that can't heal because of it. Shifting her mental model to keeping happy memories would allow her to let go of a bunch of paper that is currently torturing her, in my mind, anyway, in my evaluation. Sometimes the upgrade in the mental model is practical. Instead of thinking about value or emotion, the upgrade can be about space. For example, I'll save keepsakes as long as they fit in these two boxes or in this cabinet or in this closet. Creating a space parameter is a practical way to create your mental model. It recognizes that your space is finite and it can't be filled beyond what you can comfortably manage and live among without affecting your quality of life. Another way to upgrade your mental models is about priorities. maybe up till now, your mental models have all been about the sunk cost, the money spent, or the perceived value of the that the item retains currently. That makes the money value the priority, regardless of what it does to your living space. Another priority option could be about available space to store it safely, so all the pathways through the house are clear. If keeping and storing an item blocks a doorway or makes it hard to navigate a hall, then storing it negatively impacts your life, and making safety or ease of cleaning your home or having all of your rooms usable into the priority over the monetary value of things is a reasonable upgrade of your mental model. What we wish for you always is a better mousetrap, a better way to maintain your space and filter your belongings so it supports your best life. Examine your behaviors and attitudes about your stuff to reveal the mental models that are already in work and seek out new models that give you better results. There's always a better way to filter. There's always a way to adjust that mental model so that it doesn't err on the side of keeping everything, and with the goal that you live with the volume that you're comfortable with instead of the volume that makes you feel trapped in your own space or not being able to use your own space. And we want you to be in a place that is more comfortable than that. So that's what we're talking about today. I want to see if there's any questions at this point.
Lots of comments.
Okay.
CJ says, after the death of my in-laws who were living with us, we had let their side of the garage be filled with junk and, frankly, trash. I finally tackled it one afternoon, and although it made my husband sad to not see his parents' car in the empty space, we have since been able to twice have friends over now in our big city neighborhood with no parking.
That's awesome, because then they can come and park where the old car used to be.
Yeah. Deborah says, there's a paradox for me in decluttering. The more I get rid of, the richer I feel. I am faced with the excess I have and realize that it's a luxury to have more than enough. Regular decluttering has changed my poverty mindset to one of appreciation for the wealth I have.
Isn't that true? When you feel like you're just offloading so much stuff and how in the world did you have it all? It's a good reflection of, well, clearly I'm doing pretty well in the world and I am in a good position because I have so much extra I can give it away and I'm not suffering for the loss of it either. And that all of that goes out and can be available to someone else to use. It doesn't need to be here making me feel like I have more. It's really amazing when you get down to saving the stuff that really is valuable and important to you. And then you're really surrounded by the things that feel enriching as well. And you're much more aware of them because they're not buried amongst the excess volume. It's a way to recognize how much you have that you think is really special and important and not have it be obscured by a bunch of other stuff. It's an interesting exercise in, I have so much stuff I can give things away willy-nilly without any impact. Not even willy-nilly. I mean, you're making considered decisions, but giving stuff away and not impacting your quality of life, only improving your quality of life, reflects how well you're doing and how much you have to share. It's a good point of view.
Anita says, that cost mental model has stopped me from getting rid of art objects, paintings, tapestries, statuary that my late husband, an amateur artist, spent tons of money on. I realized I will never have the motivation or the time to try and sell these objets d'art and am planning a donation run to Habitat for Humanity next week.
That's a lovely idea because, of course, the art can be used to decorate a house that's being built to someone that wouldn't have, you know, they're going to spend their money on making sure that they have some place to sleep and they have the essentials in the house. And then art becomes secondary. The decoration part becomes secondary. And how great to let that go on and be accessible to new houses that are being furnished and filled. That's a lovely idea. And it's a perfect example of you realize that you cannot, yes, they might be worth money and yes, you might be able to sell them, but you realize that that isn't how you can spend your time. It's not ever going to come to fruition that you translate those objects from objects to money. And so acknowledging that that's not your priority here, and your priority is for those to be shared on to the next person, is great. It's a great realization, and you've come up with an excellent solution, and good for you. That's a great way to dispose of them and make sure that it goes and gets used somewhere else. Because then that's one less thing that the habitat people don't have to spend money on. They can use your art and buy the money, use the money that they have on something else, which is great.
Lise says, Disney was really good at the mental pressure to buy movies using available for a limited time and will be returning to the vault, unable to access for 10 years. I got stupid and learned a hard lesson. I'm guessing Lise is saying that she has a whole lot of Disney movies.
Right? Yeah. And, you know, there was a moment in time when that worked because those movies weren't accessible on all of these streaming services that we have. And so, you know, Disney took their moment in time and got people to buy stuff. And let me just tell you how many of those VHS tapes of Disney movies I, you know, haul off to Goodwill on a regular basis. Well, you're not the only one.
and they still maintain that scarcity model, you know, that they certainly control them.
Yes.
Well, and, you know, there have been other examples of that. I think Andrew Lloyd Webber exerts a lot of control over the creative properties that he owns and only lets them come out under, you know, creating this illusion that you better come spend the money at the moment we're ready for you to spend the money. And the other, I think one way we can fight back against that is to realize that we have lots of other choices. There are a lot of other, and yeah, maybe Disney / Marvel / Star Wars is now a Disney product.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you're crazy about those things, but there's other entertainment out there. Maybe you should look for some things you haven't seen. Watch some classics that are
right.
Easy to find and cheap.
And not super expensive, right? Yeah, exactly.
Nancy said, I appreciate this analysis. For instance, I did not know that sometimes stores may only put out a limited number of items just to make the consumer think that the store has fewer items than they actually have in their current inventory. One of the places that you see that, oddly enough, is like Marshall's and the discount stores that have a small area dedicated to home decor.
Yeah.
They'll put out one of this particular lamp, because then you see it and you go, oh, I love that lamp. I got to have that lamp right now, because there's only the one. And well, there's only the one except for the other four in the back.
Right. You know? Except for the rest of the stuff. Right. Yeah. And I think that it's also the idea that if they put everything out, then you have too many choices. If they put it all out there, then it's very crowded. It's visually overstimulating. And so part of it is that they're trying to make it visually appealing for you to pause and look and not be overwhelmed with what you're looking at. And so you end up seeing less of something because it makes it easier for your eye to rest there and for you to sit and look and decide that you need to have it. And so if you imagine the difference between how any store that has a sale table or has an area where, you know, these are the leftovers or the back stocks or whatever, Bed Bath & Beyond used to do that. They would have all the rest of the store would be very lovely and arranged in a beautiful way. And then they would have this one section of, this is all the stuff we're trying to get rid of. And it would all just be sort of shoved in there. And so they were putting as much stuff on that square footage that they allocated to the last chance area as they were having breathing space in all the other areas. And so it looks visually very different. One of them is very chaotic looking, and the rest of the store is very soothing and appealing and decorative and lovely. And, you know, that's part of how they sell you stuff. They make it look beautiful so that you'll want it. And then when you go down to the area of it's cheap here, then you have to swim your way through and you have to shove things out of the way and you have to filter to look for stuff. It makes it much harder to shop. And then it becomes, you know, people get clicked into that area because it's, you know, they go on the hunt, right? And they have to dig through stuff to find something. And then they feel like they've worked hard to find their bargain. So instead of selling it because of the look, they sort of sell because of the hunt. But it visually looks very different. And all the stores are about creating it to be beautiful, to entice you to take that beauty home with you. And if they can do that with putting 3 out when they really have 270 in the back waiting to be sold, and they just keep, you know, replenishing. If they put it all out, it would look like a warehouse.
Yeah. Well, and your interpretation is a little more generous than mine. I think that, you know, I think, yes, they want, you know, they don't want to make the place too cluttered, but some of those places are just inherently visually cluttered looking.
I think about a Ross store, yeah.
And they limit the number of individual specimens out there to conceal, I think, to some extent, that it's a commodity. What you're looking at is a mass produced commodity from China. In all likelihood, and
there are leftovers that didn't sell at another store. And
Connie said not wanting to spend money again on something you might need later. False sense of frugality.
So there is some element of keeping something against the possibility later. And the problem comes into the volume. When you use that as a filter, when the mental model is, I don't want to spend the money again, I might need this, then you're really saying, I just want to save it in case I need it. And you can then justify a vast quantity of things under the premise that you might need it someday and you don't want to have to spend the money again. And that is a really big umbrella under which to hang all of those things. And it means that you can keep 2,000 items because you might need them someday. And I guess the trick there is, if you just use that filter, you will keep way more than you need to keep. So you have to keep that filter in conjunction with some others. Will I need this in the next week? What is the possibility? Do I think that there's a 10% possibility that I'll need this, or a 90% that I'll need it?
And also weighing into that decision making is, what would it cost me to replace this thing in the future? How available will it be? As I was thinking about this topic this week, I had the thought of, people tend to collect piles and piles of pens, ink pens that have been given to them and Sharpies that they've gone and bought. And, you know, you buy a Sharpie and then you can't find it, and you're working on a project and you go buy another Sharpie, and then that one gets packed away in the project box and you buy another Sharpie. And yes, you could hold on to all the Sharpies, but will you use them before they dry up and become useless? And what would it cost you to replace it? Do you have the resources? Now, I understand if you're on a very limited income and you're really watching every penny you spend, then you want to check. And if this thing is still good, you hang on to it if you have the room. But if you're someone who has the money to replace it, expects to have the money to replace it later, then maybe handing it off to someone who needs it now, will use it now, would be a better choice than keeping it.
And even somebody that's on a limited budget, it still has space parameters, right? Like you can save things that you don't have to spend money on again, but then you have to live with all those things that you saved. And so it's going to cramp your space. So you still have to filter for, I may be saving all these things so I don't spend the money again, but I don't want to give away 75% of my living space to store so that I don't have to spend money again. So then it becomes an evaluation of, you know, here's this object that works, that solves the problem. And if I have to replace it, it's going to cost $100. That's probably more likely, that's a better choice for the space than here's a bunch of 50 cent items that take up three drawers and I'll have to spend money to replace them if I give them up. Like that gives you a way to let it go and replace it for 50 cents instead of the $100 item. You see what I'm saying? Like save room for the things that are going to cost you more to replace. And maybe you can make room in your space for the things that are cheaper to replace. I mean, you're still, even regardless of your budget, you're still balancing your ability to replace things and the available storage space in your house. If you're in a little tiny, tiny apartment, then you absolutely have to err on the side of, I can't store a million things here. I have to get it down to the bare minimum of what allows me to live comfortably here in this space and not cram up too much storage to go with the apartment. So you're always running that balancing act depending on your income and also your available space.
Tammy said, I'm not clear on mental models yet. And I wanted to try and come up with another way to explain them. It's a mental model is to some extent a small piece of your worldview. It's a metaphor, or it's a story, or it's a diagram that you keep in your head to help you understand a larger, more complex system, because you can't hold the whole large complex system all in your head at one time. And one of the kind of fun examples I found when I was looking for good material about mental models was, when a certain worldview dominates your thinking, you'll try and explain every problem you face through that worldview. This is an example from biologist Robert Sapolsky. He asks, why did the chicken cross the road? And then he gives the answers from several different experts. An evolutionary biologist might say, the chicken crossed the road because they saw a potential mate on the other side. If you ask a kinesiologist, they might say, the chicken crossed the road because the muscles in the leg contracted and pulled the leg bone forward during each step. If you ask a neuroscientist, they might say, the chicken crossed the road because the neurons in the chicken's brain fired and triggered the movement. So none of them are wrong, but none of them are seeing the whole picture.
It's all different point of view.
Yeah, and so your mental models are the things that give you your particular picture of reality. And they help us explain and understand things, and they help us make choices, but they're necessarily limited. And some of them are very constricting. Like, you know, we've talked before about the depression mindset that has gotten passed down from our grandparents of people my age and your age,
right?
Great grandparents of the younger people who are watching, but
who lived through the depression.
Yeah, and yes, a depression could happen again. Yes, you know, the world economy could crash that way, but it hasn't, you know, it hasn't happened again in nearly 100 years. And so maybe we don't need to make a lot of choices based on that particular experience that people shared, right?
Is that, does that help outcome? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that potential outcome.
Here's one little, here's a question from Anya that is closer to the present. In spring 2020, I bought a very good sewing machine, but I very rarely have the energy to use it. Sunk cost big time for me. And also, I believe it is vital to have a sewing machine because it's so useful. What now?
Well, if you consider it to be vital to have a sewing machine, then that has crossed a couple of models. Like, I think a sewing machine is vital. So I don't sew, so I don't have a sewing machine, and I don't think it's vital at my house. So you have a mental model that a sewing machine is vital, and that's awesome. And so keep the sewing machine. And so it doesn't have to be just about the fact that you spent money on the sewing machine, because they're expensive. But if it's something that you feel like is important, even if you don't do it very often, maybe that passes a couple of your mental markers about what makes it important. One, it costs money. Two, you think it's important to have one. And three, you like to do it. And so having it take up the surrendering living space to the sewing machine has passed a few hurdles for you. And then I think that makes it okay.
Well, she's mentioned that she does have room in a closet to keep it. So it's not, I mean, it may be taking up closet space that could go to something else, but it's not taking up current
living space,
functional space. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So that's one that, you know, it passes a few of your priorities and a few of your internal values, and that makes it more worthy of staying. For me, I don't know how to use the sewing machine. If I had one in the house, that would be something that I would immediately be rerouting to somebody that does know how to sew, because it isn't, it doesn't help me to store that in my closet. For you, with the skill set and the capacity to use it, that changes. Like, you're the person that makes sense to have it versus someone that doesn't know how to use it. So it makes it more reasonable that it's at your house than at mine. So then the next time that you want to evaluate it, then you can ask yourself, okay, so I've kept it for 2 years and I haven't touched it. Maybe my idea that I have to have a sewing machine isn't as realistic as I thought. But you don't have to decide that now. You can wait and see. And there may be a point where you feel like, I don't have the energy or the ability to sew anymore. It's too hard for me, or it's too difficult to move the machine, or it's, you know, I don't have the need for the end results. I don't have the need for the handmade stuff anymore. And you can evaluate it under a different set of parameters and let it go later. Like, sometimes things pass muster. It's like, there's going to be things that you filter through your filters, your models, and say, Yeah, it's okay. I can keep it. It's all right. It's one of those things that passes, because it enriches me from a whole bunch of directions. It meets several of my priorities, and therefore it's okay for it to have space in the house. Ultimately, we just want you to evaluate things with a high standard of why it needs to stay, and have that standard be particularly related to you and not what your mother would have done, or what your, you know, best friend would do, or et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to keep the same things that Ed keeps. Everybody has their own priorities about what's important to them. There.
Wolf, who's watching on Facebook, said, some things are worth having extra of and some aren't. It's figure out which is which. It's totally worth buying a case of printer paper in my house. Between school and tabletop gaming and other things, I use printed copies of things to do. Between cost savings, the fact that we will use it eventually, and that it doesn't take up crazy amounts of space. Other things, maybe not so much. I may have a slight sweater problem I need to work on. Wolf also mentions holding on to things due to living through the Great Depression or a home fire or something can be a trauma behavior rather than entirely a mental model or perspective.
Well, I mean, I think that the PTSD creates faulty mental models, like having that trauma response of, oh my God, what if we lose everything again? Means the mental model is I have to keep it all because I might lose everything again. It is a mental parameter that's been set based on a very traumatic experience, and recognizing that sometimes you're doing something out of trauma is a good mental model to examine. That's one of the mental models that got developed probably without your best care in mind. I mean, at the time, it's an emotional response to, I was very traumatized in this way, and so I need to protect myself from that trauma. But those mental models are really emotionally driven and not super evaluative or conscious. They're not usually very consciously built mental models. And so examining those that are created under duress or with distress and replacing them, that ones that are more thoughtful and more considering about what is really true for you now, is an important exercise. And it may be that you need coaching through the emotional response to the trauma before you can consider improving the mental models about what you keep and how you deal with stuff. My meaning that just changing the mental models doesn't heal or resolve or deal with your PTSD about an emotional traumatic experience. And so a lot of people find the emotional response so overwhelming that they can't get past it to making sort of practical, objective mental models about how to deal with stuff. And so maybe you have to deal with the emotion first and get comfortable and integrated around that experience before you can move on. But it is, you know, sometimes we just have lingering mental models that got thrown into place in response to an experience, and that you've never gone back and thought about them very hard. And so going back and saying, I'm evaluating whether or not to keep this based on fill in the blank. And I go back to my client in the divorce version. Her mental model is absolutely a response to her traumatic experience of that divorce. It was not something that she was expecting, and it was a big deal, and she had a hard time integrating that experience. And so she keeps those as a reminder of, these are things that were happening as I was going through this trauma. And I know that she's sort of stuck there for now. And so she can't let go of them, even though I also know from her response to them that interacting with these papers around the divorce immediately make her sad, angry, hurt again. It brings all of her feelings up. She starts talking about, you know, all the things that he was doing that were bad and wrong, and how it was all a bad experience for her. And it's been a decade, and she can't not immediately go to that emotional place when she sees those papers. And so right now, I think her mental models about keeping that stuff are working against her. They're keeping her in a negative place instead of allowing her to release and let go. And she's not ready to do that yet. And so I have to honor where she's coming from, but I can see her mental models around keeping that paper are compelling her to keep something that is making her feel tortured. And so,
and not serving any other practical need.
Yes. It definitely doesn't serve. She doesn't have any need. Like, yes, she needs the actual legal document of the divorce decree, but that's it.
Yeah.
Nothing compared to all the other stuff that she's keeping. There's just tons of other stuff that she's keeping around this, and there's no there's no practical need for the rest of the paper, and she's keeping it anyway. And so there you go. Okay, you may have some that are the same. And so it's just an idea that you need to look at the ones that you're using and see if they need to be shifted, changed, upgraded.
There are so many great comments today. I'm not going to get to them all, but I want to share two more before we get to a couple of announcements. Rowan said, the things we really need, we would never get rid of. Current cell phone, current laptops, current medications, et cetera. I think it is important to redefine need.
Mm-hmm. Because you really can, it can really just be something that you want, not that you need, or it can look like you need it when that need isn't really, I need it currently. That need is, it's part of that, that stuff in the background of, I might need it, right? It's in yeah. that realm of maybe I'll have to have this. I'll need this later.
I'm used to having this. I have habits yeah. around this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And exactly. then the other one I wanted to share, let's see. Connie said, the chicken was running away from clutter chaos.
Go chicken, go.
Okay. I want to remind those who are with us watching or listening live that our YouTube channel has more than 170 videos on lots and lots of organizing topics. Visit cfhou.com/YouTube. While you're there, subscribe to the channel and click the bell icon next to the subscribe button if you'd like to get notifications when we post new content. I want to remind everyone that we will be back next week live on at the usual time, Tuesday, October 12th, noon U.S. Central Time, live in Zoom and streaming on Facebook. Halloween is right around the corner. I know this because I helped put up decorations yesterday. And before you can say boo, it'll be time to run the annual rat race from Thanksgiving to New Year. In our next webcast, we're going to focus on streamlining your holiday season for you and your loved ones, and we'll offer a few simpler, less stressful, less cluttered solutions to holiday gift giving, decorating, and entertaining. Join us on October 12th for Uncluttered Home for the Holidays 2021, Tips for a Peaceful Season. Okay, let's talk tittle.
Let's talk about the tittle. So the title of the tittle this week is A Newer Model. So this week's assignment is to examine the mental models at work in your relationship with stuff. Take inventory of those models, and are they contributing to the difficulty of your decluttering decisions? Besides the ones we've mentioned today, what other models, rules, stories, or habits of thought come into play for you when you're trying to decide what to keep and what to let go? Identify a model that seems to be complicating or interfering with your organizing process. Think about where you got it, your parents, your own experience from the larger culture, et cetera. And then think about whether this mental model truly supports you now. Could you manage without this model? Consider shifting or modifying it to produce better results. We're hoping that you will think about ones that immediately shut down your organizing process or make you keep 100% when you know 100% isn't reasonable, and see if you can reframe that model to a new version, a newer version, upgrade to something that is more supportive of you. And then come back and tell us about it next week.
One more thread in the comments that I want to mention, just because I think it is a new mental model for many of us. Well, at least for older people. And that is the idea of sustainability and the life cycle of the things that mm-hmm. we own. And we don't have time to go deeper into that, just to say it's one more thing that we can bring into our consideration of whether to buy something in the first place and what to do with it when it's no longer serving us, is to think right. about its cost to the environment, its cost to natural resources, mm-hmm. what it takes to dispose of it, and so forth. Okay. If you're watching this on YouTube, we would love for you to join us live. To get notifications about upcoming events, we invite you to join the meetup group by visiting cfhou.com/meetup. You can also follow us on Facebook by visiting cfhou.com/Facebook.
Assuming that it's working.
Assuming it's working. Or subscribe to our mailing list by visiting cfhou.com/subscribe. We love to hear from you. We really do. So please keep your questions, comments, and topic suggestions coming on YouTube, Facebook, when it's up, or anywhere that you find us. And you can always reach us through our website at clutterfairyhouston.com.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us today. We hope that we didn't drown you too much in this mental exercise, but we're hoping that you can reframe a little bit how you decide about what's going to stay in your environment and maybe make a shift in what you're living with and letting some things go. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye. Bye.